Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hello there, movie truthers. It's Michael Leader back here once again with one of these remote Truth and Movie specials. So far we've checked in with Sophie Monks Kaufman, David Jenkins and Hannah Woodhead, and tonight we're having an Avengers-style crossover special welcoming back both David and Hannah. Welcome back both. How are you doing tonight?
I'm good.
Yeah, you too.
So tonight we're going to be talking about a topic very close to our hearts. We're going to talk about magazines. This sort of lockdown virus period has been quite a strange time for print media in particular. But David, up top, should we have a bit of an update from Little White Lies Towers? How's everything going? How's the magazine working remotely?
Well, yeah, it is a very intriguing time for I'm imagining all print publications, all writers, all editors, as not only has the kind of infrastructure shifted, and, you know, it is not as easy to sort of make these things as it was back in the good old days, but actually, like, this there are so many kind of like knock-on effects as well, in that, you know, that there are very few films actually coming out. And, like, you know, we actually, prior to the lockdown, we had a cover film locked and loaded and ready to go, and we were all set to start work. And luckily that they announced that it was being not cancelled, but like delayed sooner rather than later. So we hadn't actually started work on the magazine before we'd actually heard that this kind of cover film that we wanted to do, and which we'll probably end up still doing at a later date, had been sort of knocked down the timeline a little. And yeah, it's kind of interesting, because I think that one of the things that kind of fuels us and our passion, obviously, like, makes for these the sort of regular editions of Truth and Movies, is the fact that there are so many films coming out each week, and cinemas are packed to the gills with all these new titles, and how to navigate those things. And yeah, it seems that, you know, we're kind of just about to embark on another issue right now, and it's been a bit more, I guess, a bit, I don't want to use the word challenge, because a challenge is pejorative, and I think it's been fun, because it's a situation where we can really think in new ways, and look for new stories and new ways of what our coverage is and what it's going to be about, and how we're kind of connecting to the readers. So I'm really excited about the issue we're going to do. And, you know, if anyone listening is keen to support that side of our of the Little White Lies world, then, you know, please I implore you to subscribe and have the issue delivered to your door, not least because you don't have to queue up for an hour at a supermarket to pick it up. We're currently ticking along nicely. A lot of stuff has gone digital as well, but as in digitally focused. We're definitely retaining the good old analog side of Little White Lies as well, keeping that fire burning.
That's really good to hear. And we've been talking about this, we've been casting our minds back, thinking about our history with print media, and we've been talking about our relationship specifically with magazines. And David, you asked both Hannah and I, and also Adam Woodward as well, the other day, what our first magazines that we subscribed to as kids, and that rush of nostalgia came along. And Hannah, I think your first magazine is particularly a great one. Would you mind telling us what that is?
Yeah, so the first magazine I ever subscribed to was called My Beautiful Horses, and it was I think a monthly publication, and it came every issue, you got a free tiny plastic horse with it. And I had a very large sort of cupboard in my room just full of these plastic horses, which I think is a great image for like a David Lynch film, you know, just like horse after horse. And of course, like, being a 6-year-old or a 7-year-old, however old I was at the time, I you know, would cut their hair and kind of put stickers on them and things. So I think eventually they kind of ended up in a car boot sale somewhere. But that was really, I think, my mum was always very big on encouraging us to read, and being a, you know, a kind of kid who, a little girl who loved horses, I think she was like, aha, this is a way to surreptitiously encourage her to actually you know, get an education while she's playing. So yeah, and it worked. I still love both horses and magazines, so she really did a good job.
David, horses and magazines for you, or what sort of magazines were you reading or subscribed to as a kid?
I'm trying to think. I think subscription specifically was a tough one, because there was a really quite good news agent like very close to where I lived, and so it was like, it was actually kind of easier to just sort of run along there and pick up any mags that I want. I mean, I used to sort of get the Beano and the Dandy every week, which is pretty sort of standard issue stuff, and me and my brother would share those. And I think the first thing I actually got as a subscription was this magazine called Discovery, which when we did mention it, I don't think you guys had heard of.
No. You'll have to explain to us again.
Well, it's a weird one. It was crazy, because there was obviously, like, I think the little impetus behind my parents getting that for me was because there was an educational element to it. And the concept was that with each issue, you had a famous person from history, and it kind of told their story in a kind of magazine-y form. So it was essentially like Wikipedia before Wikipedia. So, you know, although it was a bit more creative than that, because you had illustrations and you know, occasionally photographs if it was someone more modern, and like you know, the one I remember absolutely loving, and I think it might have been one of the super early ones because there was a big craze for him at the time, was the Tutankhamun issue. And like there was this big exhibition in London, like the first time that his tomb had come to London or something, or some treasures from his tomb. And so like Tutankhamun was hot and when I was about sort of 7 or 8, and I think I had a poster of him in my bedroom wall. So that was my kind of reason for wanting to get Discovery magazine. And yeah, so one of the things with the magazine, which you guys might have some insight into this, but I'm not sure if this happens anymore, but like each issue came in a slip case, and you would take out the magazine, and it had like ring binder holes down the spine. And with every, like, the idea was that you had, you know, you with every like 20 issues, you could fill a ring binder with them, and then you could put that on your shelf, and that would be your kind of reference point. So I had like a couple of ring binders worth of discoveries, and I definitely used to kind of rank my favorite people
Their top historical figures.
Yeah, yeah. I loved Marco Polo as well for some reason, because I also love polos. So I think there was like a kind of link there. I don't think I delved very deep into the actual text. It was more of a kind of looking at pictures of them, and I generally also liked people with moustaches as well. So that was another little. So
I feel like I'm learning so much already. Exactly, we're 5 yeah. minutes in. But I think that I can't speak to the international magazine market, but no matter kind of how old you are, if you had a magazine subscription in the last sort of, if you were a child with a magazine subscription in the last, you know, 20, 30 years, it will have had a ring binder or some way for you to collect it. I remember after My Beautiful Horses, we had the Horrible Histories magazine, which was a weekly magazine, and it came with I think at first there was a ring binder, and then you got kind of those cardboard boxes, like file things to put them in, because there were so many. We had stacks of those magazines. And I mean, I did go on to a history degree, so I think it was like money well spent for my mum. But like when we asked this question on Twitter, so many people were like, yeah, I had this magazine that came with a ring binder. So someone was making bank like on this.
I think those magazines still exist. If you go into a large WH Smiths, there's like a whole section where issue by issue you build a collection or build a model, or
and the first one is always £1.99 and then the next issue is like £5. That's how they get you.
I remember growing up when they'd be advertised on telly.
In the
bad old days.
The Lord of the Rings chess magazine, I recall being a very big thing. And wow. I really wanted it. My mum was like, no. Because, you know, that's like 60 issues at a fiver a pop for a chess set.
Those magazines, I was always very, very like, yeah. I stood clear of those because I was very aware of, seeing the TV adverts and thinking, wow, that's a lot of bang for your buck at £1.99 for as an introductory offer, and then you know you would, I mean, £5 is like cheap. I think they were more like £8 or £9, like after that first one. So they put all their money in a massive glitzy advertising campaign. Because you know, once you've got one, if you decide to subscribe, I mean, then you're hooked basically. So.
When I was mulling over the subscription question, for me there are so many different types of subscriptions. So there'd be Shoot magazine coming through my door, a football magazine for kids every week. That would be delivered by a lad on the paper round from our local newsagents. But then there'd be magazines that I'd pick up on the way home from primary school with my gran. Shout out to Sanford's in Swinton. That would be the Beano and the Dandy. But then I suppose there's a point of departure here where we're talking about magazines that our parents or family would be getting for us to keep us out of trouble or maybe inspire us to learn a bit more. What were the first magazines that you went and got yourself and maybe formed the identity that you now have? So the gateway into who you became.
I remember when I was how old would I have been? There was, in that kind of weird, you know, end of year six, beginning of year seven phase, I remember buying a lot of Top of the Pops magazine and like Smash Hits and those kind of things. And then I distinctly remember like when I was about 14, it was, I started listening to, you know, like Arctic Monkeys and things. They got really big. So I was like straight into Enemy. I discovered Enemy. And that for me was like, you know, the floodgates opening. I felt very cool and very like in the know, because no one else in my year at school, or not in my class anyway, read Enemy. So I'd take that to school every week. It would come on a Wednesday morning. The paper boy would bring it because we got it from the newsagents. And I would take it in and I'd be sat on the bus reading it and I'd be like, I'm very cosmopolitan, I don't know about all the rest of you, but I know music and I read magazines that are published in London, where I'm going to live when I'm older. So that for me was like, you know, it felt like this whole other world had opened up for me.
David, were you an Enemy reader?
Yeah, I was actually. And Melody Maker as well. I'd get both and always feel that NME was the superior magazine, but I understand that Melody Maker in its back in its heyday was rather good. But I guess magazines have always been a big part of my life. Although I think maybe the definition that I'm going to use here is probably not right. But like, so my dad is a huge has been for my entire life collector of comics, and much of my youth was spent like going around comic shops. And because my you know, this makes my dad sound a bit seedy, but actually, you know, it was just a regular you know, passion, I guess. He would buy, you know, he would buy a lot of comics, and he would at the various comic shops in, like, there was one in central in Covent Garden called Krypton Comics, which was the main one. Does that sound familiar to you, Michael? Krypton Comics,
way before my time. Okay. I think some of these places,
and Forbidden Planet as well, but when it was in a slightly different place, and more, and definitely more kind of like hardcore nerdy comic focused. And Orbital Comics as well. He used to basically have like these, you know, all these kind of bits of money down on various like vintage comics. So we'd sort of do this loop every week, and he would sort of put another 20 quid down on some like early Action Comics, or like, you know, the first appearance of Hulk or something like that. And you know, it was his kind of like, it was a sort of another mortgage for him. Anyway, the reason I'm saying that to you is because I really never got into comics. I think my dad really wanted me and my brother to be, because then that would actually like give him more of a reason, because he could basically say, oh, I'm doing it for the kids. It's fine. My brother managed to, I think just by pure kind of force of will, ended up getting into Iron Man comics, which was lucky, because Iron Man was pretty much the only Marvel character that my dad wasn't at all interested in. So he was very happy for my brother to have Iron Man to himself. So he would buy my brother Iron Man magazines, and I would just be like, I know, I just want different magazines. And I think the first one I really got into was this magazine called Nintendo Magazine System.
Oh yeah,
AKA NMS. I think it featured recently in Under the Silver Lake. I don't know if it was that one or a slightly different one.
That was Nintendo Power. So these are the officially licensed Nintendo magazines. Nintendo Power was in the States. And then, yeah, the Nintendo Magazine System over here.
Right.
Ran for many years.
Yeah, I'm imagining that there was some kind of editorial crossover there. But it was like, I had a SNES, and I was really into it. And the one thing that I really, I mean, this is something that like maybe is a kind of like character thing, but like I was really into cheats, like really obsessed with cheats. And like, you know, when you get a magazine and sometimes there's like a page you flick to, like, you know, you just want to get to that bit first and just check. And I'd always just buy a Nintendo Magazine System and go straight to the cheats page. And just there would be a little pang of disappointment if like none of the games I had any kind of cheat codes, or if it was one that I already knew or something like that. It was a real proper kind of like, oh my god, I've unlocked the universe if there's a game where I've got a cheat code. And then you'd obviously go and try and input the cheat code, and it would be like impossible, because it'd be some like long string of, you know, BABA start up down, you know, all that. So yeah, I was really into Nintendo Magazine System for the cheats, and then but beyond that, the thing that was like super important to me was actually Time Out,
right?
And that wasn't a subscription that I had. That was my dad has been a subscriber like my entire life. Like he was subscribing to it in like the 80s, so like as long as I've lived, as long as I was living with my parents, I was getting Time Out delivered to the house, and then obviously I left home, went to university, and then worked for Time Out for like 5 years. So, but yeah, it was the cause of much consternation because. Me and my dad and my brother used to kind of race to get home first from school, because my dad was a teacher as well, so we'd all end at the same time. And it was on a Wednesday to see who could... or it was occasionally arrived on a Tuesday, but it was basically to see who could get the subscriber copy of Time Out first and open it up, and we'd all circle what we wanted to watch on TV. So this was when the TV listings were like 40 pages or something. It was amazing.
Sorry. What a rosy picture you're painting. Yeah. David. And we're learning so much about you.
Yeah, this is. I should really save all this for the memoirs, shouldn't I? Yeah.
I do wonder whether, you know, even though there's an age range between the three of us, we all kind of grew up during a time where there were just so many magazines on the shelves. You know, David, even though you mentioned Nintendo, the official Nintendo magazine, there would also be third-party independent magazines as well. So I was very much into video games and music at very important parts of my childhood. So I'd be reading PC Zone and PC Gamer, the official PlayStation magazine, and you know, third-party knockoffs as well, which would have very different points of view, access, attitudes. And then I hit a certain point. I did read Melody Maker, but I got onto the Melody Maker ship as it was sinking. And then jumped ship to NME, and then Kerrang, and then it was just Kerrang for a long time, as I was a new metal kind of goth type for most of my early teenage years, pinning up Cradle of Filth posters in our physics classroom. Wow. And so on.
What?
never Metal Hammer.
Well, no, Metal Hammer was a bit later, because it's a bit scary when you're 12 years old, the concept of actual metal. You just want to, you know, read up on Nirvana or something instead.
Can I ask you a question, Michael? This is slightly off topic. Were you ever into, like, White Dwarf?
Oh, Warhammer?
Yeah.
Yeah, I was. I knew towards it. The tail end of primary school. But I was never into it as much as my dad was. It was one of those deals where I do not have an artistic bone in my body. I can't paint or draw or anything. My dad is incredibly talented at that, and he would be painting and sculpting and moulding my Space Marine armies or whatever it would be. And then one of my best friends at school, we'd go together to the Bolton Games Workshop every Saturday morning and play various Warhammer 40k or Warhammer. But yeah, White Dwarf is still going strong.
Henry Cavill is big into it, apparently. That's what he's been doing in lockdown, is doing Warhammer.
That's amazing.
Check out his Instagram, he's posted a lot about Warhammer. There you go.
How would you like to look 5 years younger? In a clinical study, people that had volume added with Juvederm Voluma XC in the cheeks perceived themselves as looking 5 years younger at 6 months after treatment. Look younger, feel like you. Add volume for lift and contour in the cheeks with Juvederm Voluma XC. Reverse signs of aging by adding volume to smooth laugh lines with Juvederm Volure XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
There's one thing we haven't mentioned yet, and that's film magazines, right?
Yeah.
So when do film magazines come into it, and what was it?
For me, it was, I think, well, I grew up in the kind of early noughties, so it was Empire and Total Film, really. I was a very, I mean, I came from a kind of small little town just outside of Sheffield, so there weren't really a lot of, there wasn't a lot of access to magazine shops, like specialist shops. So it was basically what could you get at the newsagents and what could you get at the supermarket, and those two were, you know, the most kind of readily available. So I remember picking up my first Empire when I must have been about 14. So this was, I had at one point a subscription to Enemy and Empire at the same time, and my mum was like, you know, this can't go on, you're bankrupting the family with your love of pop culture. So I chose Empire, and I had that until I went to university. So I just remember very kind of distinctly being a religious reader. Every month it was cover to cover, and then my brother would take it, or my sister would take it, if there was something they were interested in. And I had stacks upon stacks of them in my bedroom in this huge kind of ottoman. And I would reread them. I'd take them out and like look at them again and put them back all in order. I like to keep them all in order. And then when I was about 17, maybe, I remember going into the WH Smiths in Sheffield City Centre and seeing this magazine, which I hadn't seen before. And it had Natalie Portman on the cover. And I was a big Natalie Portman fan, you know, 17-year-old girl. I thought she was amazing. So I was like, oh, that looks really cool. What is that? And it was Little White Lies. It was the Black Swan issue. And that was the first time I encountered the magazine. And I always feel a little bit kind of like nostalgic about that memory, because it's so clearly etched in my mind. And after that, I didn't have a subscription, but I would buy it kind of whenever I went into town to see my friends. I would go to WH Smith and buy it. It was a very strange experience 2.5 years ago to have an interview and subsequently get a job at this magazine, which had really like opened my eyes, I guess, to a different side of film. Because Empire and Total Film were great for kind of the big, you know, the blockbuster titles and the kind of classics, but there was this whole kind of world of independent cinema which I just wasn't aware of and hadn't really encountered before I started reading Little White Lies.
That's really sweet. The closest I have to that is that I was a subscriber to Empire for a long time, and I don't know if it was the same for you or Hannah or David, but I developed quite a relationship with some of the writers, you know, as a reader, particularly Kim Newman. And during the phase when I was reading the magazine religiously, he had a section where it was, ask, this guy knows everything about film, ask him a question and he'll take a stab at it. And I still have the copies of the issues where I sent in questions for him and he actually took them seriously and answered them. And the two questions I asked were, who's appeared as themselves the most in films? And who's saved the world the most time on the big, most times on the big screen? And I think the answer for most times as themselves at that time was Larry King. And there was even like a little sort of additional bit saying, unless we take into account people who played characters with their own names, like does Roy Rogers count as playing himself in all those films where he played Roy Rogers? And I was just so, as a kid, as a whatever 10, 11 year old, so bowled over thinking that people were taking this thing seriously. And I see Kim Newman at screenings and stuff. I've never actually spoken to him, and one day I'm going to completely embarrass myself.
You should speak to him. He's super nice.
No, of course, you know, it's so personal, isn't it, to reveal stuff like that. My first issue of Little White Lies, it's a weird one, it was the pack-in mini issue in the Persepolis DVD.
Wow.
Still have that DVD.
That's niche.
Yeah, we did a lot of little mini issues with. There was a distributor then called Momentum, who really liked taking the issues and sort of miniaturizing them for the DVD cases. I guess it was a nice little easy thing to do, really. But yeah, that's funny you say that about the writing in. I remember I've never myself written into a magazine because I'm too lazy, but I remember my friend had an Amiga, I think it was, and I think it was an Amiga, and I've got a friend called Tom Lamont, and I remember he wrote a letter into an Amiga magazine, and it was a very, unlike yours, which are quite kind of broad and searching and wide-eyed, his letter was like, oh, on level it was like that one in The Simpsons where he says, you know, Itchy clearly strikes the same tone when Itchy plays scratches ribcage like a xylophone, you know. It was one of those type of questions, and it was like, on level 32 of this kind of boring game, I can't find the special bell that gets your, you know, and the guy they replied to his letter, but they just spent the whole reply ripping the piss out of him because his surname was Lamont, because at the time there was a politician called Norman Lamont, and he had like, and he was known for having these kind of Martin Scorsese eyebrows, and the whole reply was basically, oh, Tom Lamont, any relation? Have you got massive bushy eyebrows? Are you in the Tory party? Are you really boring? And it just ended. And it was like, I think he was absolute, I'm pretty sure that killed his relationship to magazines, actually. So, but for same story for me with film magazines, Empire and Total Film, yeah, all the way. I think I probably had those. Again, it was my dad who subscribed to them both, so I just read them. With Empire and Total Film, we probably had those. I'd say most of the 90s, and I think my dad still remained a subscriber through till four or five years ago. I think he stopped because his magazine comic spending was getting he retired, so he had to cut back expenditure on his print product buying. So and then I think I bought my first Sight and Sound in the late 90s. I think the first one I ever bought was that there was a Boogie Nights issue of Sight and Sound, and they had Roller Girl on the cover. I think it must have been about like 97. And that was a real kind of like, you know, revelatory moment, because, you know, I definitely was, as a late teenager and 20 something, a bit more like, you know, wanna be serious, you know, sued, pretentious, taping like subtitled films off the TV. I'd tape them and watch them and like be really annoying and obnoxious and tell people they had to watch them, even though I barely understood them myself. I think initially I saw Sight and Sound as a bit of a kind of status symbol thing, and sort of knew it was the kind of hardcore film magazine for those people who thought of themselves as like serious cinephiles, and I definitely used to love the reviews, and I would read all the, like, my main focus was on reviews back in the early days, and I just thought the Sight and Sound reviews were the best. Would do things like, I remember reading a review of, so this is just come to me. I remember reading a review of Gummo, the Harmony Korine film in the Sight and Sound, and discovering it from the, like, I'd never heard of it before, but reading the review and seeing the picture of the kid eating spaghetti in the bath and thinking, oh, that looks intriguing, and it got some really negative reviews because I think some people were like outraged by it, and this, the review in Sight and Sound was actually proper kind of fair and analytical and wasn't being sort of hyperbolic in any way. And I remember it actually was like, name check Robert Bresson in the review. And from that, I then went and tried to watch it. Like, it was like, okay, I'm going to watch as many Robert Bresson films as I can. Actually, no, it was after I'd then seen Gummo. I was like, I'm gonna reread the Sight and Sound review and then go on to watch as many Robert Bresson films, because if it's as good as that, then this Robert Bresson guy must, you know, he must know some shit. So,
but so Hannah, you mentioned reading The Quiet Lies and then writing for them. David, you also had that experience of, I guess, reading Time Out and then working for them and then Sight and Sound maybe as well. So what was the experience when you finally crossed over to the other side?
It's weird. It's you know, you kind of almost can't believe it for the first couple of times, but then I think you get used to it quite quickly. And I think that, I mean, there's like, this is a bit off topic, I guess, but I definitely remember like using my inner science. When I started working for Time Out, I was basically a kind of like intern in their media library for about a year. And that year basically helped me to, like, it was a paid internship, which is like, you know, and I basically used that year to just write for any and all section of the magazine. I was proper kind of like, you know, really up for any kind of like helping out, and did food reviews and did book reviews and was massively out of my depth, but used that year as a kind of way to hone my skills. And I'd started talking to the editor, Dave Calhoun, because he'd sort of occasionally come down to the media library, and I'd sort of try and, you know, I'd sort of look at, you know, read the reviews that he'd written, and then sort of make some comment about, oh, that looks good, and then, you know, we could, like, you know, start off a conversation. But and you know, gradually kind of wheedled my way in there. But yeah, there was definitely, like, initially, you know, that kind of idea of, oh my god, I can't believe I'm writing for this thing that I absolutely treasure and has, like, basically made me the person I am today in terms of, like, the art I'm interested in, which I think is, you know, so important for most people. But yeah, I definitely felt for, like, at least the first couple of years. In fact, I still feel it today, like, massively, like, you can always do more, you can always know more. There are always people better than you. That, you know, like, there is a sense that, you know, you're kind of, you're having to kind of cheat a little bit, you know, in terms of, like, how much you really know about a thing and how much insight you can really give on something. So there was definitely, like, in those early days, I was really kind of, like, trying way too hard. And I'm someone who I very, very, very rarely read anything I've written. Or I don't think I've kept much of my, not because I'm ashamed of it, but, like, I've not really kept much of my Time Out stuff because I'm just like, oh, I don't really ever want to read it again.
Not even the very first thing? So not framed somewhere?
It may be somewhere. I think it was, do you know what? In fact, this is kind of going back to more on topic. I think at the time, and I think it links to this idea of when you write something on the internet, you kind of have this belief that it's going to be there forever, and then you get, and we're in this age now where you have there's a constant stream of people who are saying, "Oh man, I wrote this amazing essay for this website that's now gone bust and been taken down," and, you know, this realization that the website isn't infinite. I think when I started at Time Out, my feeling was that print was infinite. And that there would always be opportunities for me to just grab an old copy or a back issue, or, you know, at Time Out we had this huge, you know, the media library that I worked in just had, like, you know, 100 of every issue from the last, you know, 10 years. So I just thought, oh, it would be easy for me to just grab all my issues. And then, you know, it got to my last day and I was just like, yeah, you know, I had a lot of issues, but they just they gradually just ended up being chucked out when I moved house. I moved house a couple of years ago, and it was just like, I've gotten, you know, I was trying to be, like, unsentimental about it, and but you know, the good stuff I remember.
We're getting such a great insight into the future David Jenkins memoirs tonight.
Oh god,
David, thank you so much. Hannah, did your relationship to magazines change once you got to the other side? Do you still read magazines now?
Yeah, I do. Yeah, I've always been a collector of magazines. I love good print, I love interesting print, and I do love a good kind of, whenever I'm in Soho, I'll go down to Good News, which is the fantastic newsagent on Berwick Street, that's kind of become my haunt now that Wardour News is sadly closed. and Mag Culture as well in Clerkenwell. These are shops I love to just kind of go and look around and see the kind of wealth of really interesting and really exciting print that's out there that isn't sold in Sainsbury's or WH Smith's anymore. Just, you know, things that I kind of, again, like when I discovered Little White Lies for the first time, things that I just had no idea existed until I moved to London and was able to kind of get ready access to them. So yeah, I mean, it takes kind of quite a lot. I'm not a person who will just pick something up and, you know, be like, okay, this looks fine. I like to kind of take my time and like look at different things and kind of agonize over it, because I think print as well now is good print is expensive. You know, you can pay sort of £10 for a magazine and it'll be half adverts, which is one of my kind of bugbears. But, you know, I do understand that magazines are in a position where they're kind of beholden to advertisers a lot of the time, and that's kind of why you end up with these great big tomes which are just half high fashion pictures of models and perfume samples. But I have, when I see something like a really good issue of GQ or Esquire or Dazed online, I will make the effort to go out and buy these magazines. I do kind of believe in supporting the journalism that you enjoy and that you care about and that you want to see more of. And I kind of think working in print, you are... It would be strange to me if I worked in this job and didn't kind of take an active interest in other print publications and buying magazines and kind of, I don't know, investing back into the industry, I guess.
Yeah, my magazine reading has fallen off once I stopped having what felt like infinite space to fill. Once I realised, you know, when I moved house and I had, I think it was 9 or 10 years worth of magazines piled up in the cupboards, I'd had to recycle or chuck them out or take them to the charity shop. And now I'm a bit more sparing. I have a shelf which is all Sight and Sounds, all Little White Lies, and then the select issues of Film Commentary I was able to track down in print, plus a couple of other key magazines that I'm keeping. Everything else I have to clear out. There are a few magazines I still go out of my way to get, though. There's one video game magazine that launched in the last year, which I think is fantastic. And what's great about it is that it's relatively cheap to buy as well. Even, you know, Hannah, you said that good print is expensive. Even throwaway print is expensive now. Well, you know, we think about buying magazines with your pocket money as a kid. Now you'd be paying £4, £5, £6 for an issue of magazines that should be bought alongside your sweets. But Wireframe, which is this video game magazine that is part funded by the Raspberry Pi Foundation, so it's like half about learning how, teaching kids how to code, teaching young adults and adults actually how to code, but is also a really great magazine about how games work, whilst also approaching it with a real video game fan attitude. It really feels like the successor to a lot of those 90s video game and PC magazines I read as a kid. But it's fortnightly, it's cheap, and it's just packed full of great stuff. I love that one. But there's also such a boom in smaller run journals.
Yeah.
One fell through my door today, in fact. I'm going to give it a shout out. It's called Nonfiction, published by UCL and the Open City Documentary Festival. It's edited by friend of the mag, Matt Turner. And it's an ambitious purchase on my part. I don't fully understand even the titles of some of these essays, but I'm hoping to learn something from every single one of them.
That's how I felt about getting a New Yorker subscription last year. I was like, this is going to improve me as a person, and I haven't read about half of them that are set in my room. I have the will, you know. I'm like, eventually I'll do it.
I think getting a New Yorker subscription is definitely a rite of passage. I think everyone does it for a year. I did it for a year as well in my old flat and kept most issues. And because you keep them, because you always think, oh, I'm gonna spend a weekend going back through all the issues. I would open them and look first for any kind of film based feature. So. But my wife now subscribes to the LRB, which is great, which is really good, actually. Like, I'm actually sort of, you know, one of the things I've been able to do during the Coronageddon is that actually getting a bit of time to flick through the LRB and read some like random, very long article, essay, analytical piece on just some random thing or book or something, or three books on Nixon. You know, it's interesting. You know, it's a really amazing old legacy publication that's still kind of doing exactly what it did back in the day, which I think is very cool.
So there are still magazines that are keeping us out of trouble and broadening our horizons.
Sadly, there aren't free horses, but, you know, we can't have it all.
I think if our designer had her way, Little White Lies would come with free toys every issue.
We need to do that one day.
I was talking to her today, and she had some absolutely insane ideas. So anyway, we'll hear more about that in due course.
I can't wait to hear more. Listeners, please let us know about your formative experiences with magazines or any recommendations that you'd like to give us to check out magazines that are still in print. We'd love to hear them at the usual channels, at LDRealize on Twitter, truthandmovies@tcolondon.com, or at the comment section at ldrealize.com/podcast. David Hanna, it's been an absolute pleasure talking with you this evening.
Thanks, Michael.
Thanks, Michael.
I'm Michael Eder, and as always, this has been a 7 Digital production.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.